"More than two brigades in theater," the man insisted. "One more brigade equivalent in Kuwait, but that is all."
"Is that so? Well, I have lost more than a division in strength in the last 3 hours, and I still don't know what I'm facing here. Second Corps has been badly mauled. First Corps has run into something and is continuing the attack now. Third Corps is so far untouched. I can continue the attack to Riyadh, but I need more information on what I'm facing."
The commanding general, a man of 60 years, was not a fool, and he still felt that he could win. He still had about 4 divisions' worth of combat power. It was just a matter of directing it properly. He actually felt lucky that air attacks from American and Saudi forces had been so light. He'd learned a few other lessons fast. The disappearance of 3 command sections had made him cautious, at least for his own safety. He was now a full kilometer from the radio transmitters attached to his armored command vehicle, a BMP-1 KSH, his handset at the end of a lengthy spool of commo wire. He himself was surrounded by a squad of soldiers, who did their best not to listen to the excitement in their commander's voice.
"Damn, look at all those SAM tracks," a Kiowa observer said over the radio, from 8 clicks north.
His pilot made the call while the observer did a count.
"Marauder lead, this is Mascot 3. I think we have the enchilada."
3 lead, go," was the terse reply.
6 bimps, 10 trucks, 5 SAM tracks, 2 radar tracks, and 3 ZSU-23s in a wadi.
Recommend approach from the west. Say again, approach from the west.
It was far too much defensive firepower to be much of anything other than the Army of God's mobile command section. The SAM launchers were all French Crotales, and those little fuckers were scary, Mascot 3 knew. But they should have picked a different spot. This was one of those situations where you were better in the open, or even on high ground, so that your SAM radars could see better.
3 lead, can you illuminate?
Affirmative, tell us when. Radar tracks first.
The Apache leader, a captain, was hugging the ground to the west, creeping forward at 30 knots now, coming up on what he thought was a ridgeline that would tip over into the wadi. Slowly, slowly, letting his own mast sensor do the looking, the pilot flew the airplane like a kid learning to parallel park while the gunner manned the sensors.
"Hold it right there, sir," the gunner advised from his front seat.
3 lead, start the music," the pilot called.
The Kiowa lit up its laser illuminator, an invisible infrared beam that aimed first at the far radar track. It was actually a wheeled vehicle, but nobody was being particular. On notification that the target was lit up, the Apache tilted its nose up and loosed first one hellfire, then another 5 seconds later.
The general heard the shouted warning from 1,000 meters away. Only one of the radar vehicles was actually transmitting, and that intermittently as an electronic security measure. It was radiating now and caught the inbound missile. One of the launcher trucks rotated its 4-tube mount and fired, but the Crotale lost lock when the hellfire angled down and went harmlessly ballistic. The radar vehicle blew apart a moment later, and the second one 6 seconds after that. The commanding general of the Army of God stopped talking then and ignored the incoming conversation from Tehran. There was quite literally nothing for him to do but crouch down, which his bodyguards made him do. All 4 Apaches of the troop were hovering in a semicircle now, waiting for their troop commander to ripple off his hellfires. This he did, about 5 seconds apart, letting the Kiowa guide them in, switching from target to target. Next came the SAM launcher vehicles, followed by the Russian-made gun tracks. Then there was nothing left to protect the BMP command tracks. It was utterly heartless, the general saw. Men tried shooting back, but at first there was nothing to shoot at. Some people looked. Others pointed. Only a few ran. Most stayed and tried to fight. The missiles seemed to come from the west. He could see the yellow-white glow of rocket motors racing through the darkness like fireflies, but he couldn't see anything shooting them. And one after another, the air defense vehicles were destroyed, then the BMPs, then the trucks. It took less than 2 minutes, and only then did the helicopters begin to appear. The security detachment for his mobile command post was a company of picked infantrymen. They fought back with heavy machine gun fire and shoulder-launched rockets,
but the ghostly shapes of the helicopters were too far away. The man-portable missiles couldn't seem to find them. His men tried, but then the tracers lanced out, reaching for them like beams of light into an area now bright with vehicle fires. A squad here, a section there, a pair there. The men tried to run, but the helicopters closed in, firing from only a few hundred meters away, hurting them in a cruel, remorseless game. The radio handset was dead in his hand, but he still held it, watching. "Lead, too. I got a bunch to the east," a pilot told the Apache commander. "Get 'em," the flight leader ordered, and one of the attack choppers ducked south around the remains of the command post. Nothing to do, no place to flee. Three of his men shouldered their weapons and fired. Others tried to run, but there was no running and no hiding. Whoever flew those aircraft were killing everything they saw. Americans, had to be, angry at what they'd been told. Might even be true, the general thought, and if... "How do you say tough shit in Raghead?" the gunner asked, taking his time to make sure he got every one. "I think they got the message," the pilot said, turning the chopper around and scanning for additional targets. "Angel 6, Angel 6, this is Marauder 6 Actual. This sure looked like a CP, and it's toast now," the troop commander called. "We are RTB for bullets and gas. Out." "Well, get him back!" Darii shouted at the communications officer on the line. The intelligence chief in the room didn't say anything, suspecting that they'd never talk to the army commander again in this lifetime. The worst part was not knowing why. His intelligence assessment on arriving American units had been correct. He was sure of that. How could so few do so much harm? "They had a pair of brigades, regiments, whatever, there, didn't they?" Ryan asked, getting the latest upload from the battlefield onto his projection TV in the sit room. "Yep," General Moore nodded. He noted with some pleasure that even Admiral Jackson was pretty quiet. "Not anymore, Mr. President." "Jesus, those guardsmen are doing just fine." "Sir," Ed Foley said, "just how far do you want to take this?" "Do we have any doubts at all that it was Darii personally who made all these decisions?" It was, Ryan thought, a dumb question. Why else had he told the citizens that? But he had to ask the question, and the others in the sit room knew why. "None," the DCI replied. "Then we take it all the way, Ed. Will the Russians play?" "Yes, sir, I think they will." Jack thought of the plague now dying out in America. Thousands of the innocent had already died, with more yet to follow. He thought of the soldiers, sailors, and airmen at risk under his distant command. He found himself thinking, even, of the UIR troops who'd followed the wrong banner and wrong ideas because they hadn't had the chance to select their country or its leader, and were now paying the price for that mistake of birthplace. If they were not completely innocent, then neither were they completely guilty, because, for the most part, soldiers merely did what they were told. He also found himself remembering the look in his wife's eyes when Katie had arrived by helicopter on the South Lawn. There were times when he was allowed to be a man just like other men, except for the power he held in his hands. "Find out," the president said coldly. It was a sunny morning in Beijing, and Adler knew more than the other people in the discussion. It hadn't been much of a detailed dispatch, just the high points, which he'd shown to the defense attaché, and the army colonel had told him to trust every word. But the information wasn't widely known. The TV reports had to come out over military communications nets, and because of the time of day in most of America, those hadn't reported much beyond the commencement of combat action. If the PRC was in cahoots with the UIR, they might yet believe that their distant friends held the upper hand. It was worth a try, Sextate thought, sure that POTUS would back him up. "Mr. Secretary, welcome again," the foreign minister said graciously. And again Zhang was there, silent and enigmatic as he tried always to be. "Thank you." Adler took his regular seat. It wasn't as comfortable as the one in Taipei. "These new developments, can it be true?" his official host asked. "That is the public position of my president and my country," the Secretary of State replied. thus it had to be true. "Do you have sufficient forces to protect your interests in that region?"
"Minister, I am not a military expert, and I cannot comment on that," Adler replied.
That was entirely true, but a man in a position of strength would probably have said something else.
"It would be a great misfortune if you cannot," Zhang observed.
It might have been fun to inquire about the PRC's position on the matter, but the answer would have been neutral and meaningless. Nor would they have said anything about the presence of the Eisenhower Battle Group, now flying patrols over the international waters of the Formosa Strait. The trick was to make them say anything at all.
World situation occasionally requires re-examination of one's position on many things, and one must sometimes think carefully about one's friendships, Adler tried. It lay on the table for half a minute.
"We have been friends since your President Nixon first courageously came here," the foreign minister said after reflection. "And we remain so, despite the occasional misunderstanding."
"That is good to hear, Minister. We have a saying about friendship in time of need."
"Okay, think about that one. Maybe the news reports are true. Maybe your friend Darii will succeed." The bait dangled for another 15 seconds.
"Really, our only area of permanent discord is America's position on what your president inadvertently called the two Chinas. If only this could be regularized," the minister mused.
"Well, as I told you, the president was trying to express himself to reporters in a confusing situation."
"And we are to disregard it?"
"America continues to feel that a peaceful solution to this provincial dispute serves the interests of all parties." That was status quo ante, a position established by a strong, confident America whom China would not challenge openly.
"Peace is always preferable to conflict," Zhang said. "But how long must we show such great forbearance? These recent events have only served to illustrate the central problem."
A very small push, Adler noted. "I understand your frustration, but we all know that patience is the most valuable of virtues."
"At some point, patience becomes indulgence."
The foreign minister reached for his tea.
"A helpful word from America would be most gratefully received."
"You ask that we alter our policy somewhat?"
Sextate wondered if Zhang would speak again after altering the course of the conversation ever so slightly.
"Merely that you see the logic of the situation. It would make the friendship of our two nations far more substantial, and it is, after all, a minor issue to countries such as ours."
"I see," Adler replied.
And he did. It was certain now. He congratulated himself for making them tip their hand. The next call on this would have to be made in Washington, assuming they had the time there for something other than a shooting war. The 10th ACR crossed back into Saudi territory at 0330 Lima. The Buffalo Cav was now spread in a line 30 miles across. In another hour, they would be astride the UIR Army's supply line, having gotten here without any notice. The force was moving faster now, almost 30 miles in an hour. His lead elements had found a few patrol and internal security units in UIR territory, mainly single vehicles which had been dispatched immediately upon sighting. There would be more now, as soon as they hit the next road. It would be MP units at first, whatever the enemy called them, used for traffic control. There had to be a lot of fuel rolling down the road to KKMC, and that was the first mission of the Buffalo soldiers. 2nd Brigade of the Immortals had been under fire for nearly an hour when orders came to go forward, and the armored vehicles of the former Iranian Armored Division moved with a will. The 2-star in command was in back of the flanking 3rd Brigade now, listening rather than talking, wondering about and thankful for the absence of American air power. Corps artillery had arrived and set up without firing to reveal its presence. They might not last long, but he wanted the benefit of their presence. The opposing force could hardly be as much as a full brigade on this side of the highway, and he had double that. And even if he did face a complete brigade, then his Iraqi comrades on the far side would loop around to support him, as he would for them if he found a clear field. Over the radio, on the move in order to prevent being attacked by artillery or helicopters, he exhorted his commanders to press the attack, as he followed on in an open-topped command vehicle. Now, if his enemy would just sit still in the positions they'd held successfully for the first attack, he would see about things. Lobo passed Phase Line Manassas 20 minutes late, to the quiet anger of Colonel Eddington, who thought that he'd allowed ample time for the maneuver. But that damned criminal lawyer, a redundancy he'd joked more than once, commanding Hoot Owl, was well forward again, covering the right, while his battalion XO took the left, calling fire but not taking any shots of his own.
"Wolfpack 6, this is Hoot 6, over."
"Six actual, Hoot," Eddington replied.
"They're coming on, sir, two brigades on line, packed in pretty close, advancing over Phase Line High Point right now."
"How close are you, Colonel?"
3,000. I am pulling my people back now."
They had designated safe travel lanes for that. Hoot hoped that everybody remembered where they were. The redeployment would take them east, to screen the right edge of the flanking battalion task force.
"Okay, clear the field, Counselor."
"Roger that, Professor Eddington. Hoot Owl is flying," the misplaced lawyer replied. "Out." In a minute he told his driver to see how fast he could go in the dark. It was something the NASCAR fan was just as pleased as hell to demonstrate. The same report arrived 4 minutes later from the left. His one brigade was facing four. It was time to narrow those odds some. His artillery battalion shifted fire. His tank and Bradley commanders started sweeping the horizon for movement, and the three mechanized battalions started rolling forward to meet their enemy on the move. Company and platoon commanders checked their lines for proper interval. The battalion commander was in his own command tank on the left side of the line. The S-3 operations officer backed up the right. As usual, the Bradleys were slightly back on the 54 Abrams tanks, their mission to sweep the field for infantry and support vehicles. The falling artillery was common shell, and now VT proximity, to make life very hard on tanks with open hatches and people dumb enough to be in the open. Nobody thought of armored knights. The battlefield was too dispersed for that. It was more like a naval battle fought on a sandy, rocky sea, which was every bit as hostile to human life as the conventional kind, and about to become more so. Eddington stayed with White Fang, which was essentially an advancing reserve force, as it became clear that the enemy was advancing on both flanks, and leaving the center with a screening force, if anything.
"Contact," a platoon leader called on his company net. "I have enemy armored vehicles at 5,000 meters. He checked his IVUS display to confirm, again, that there were no friendlies out there. Good. Hoot Owl was clear. There was only a red force to his front.
The moon was up now. Less than a quarter of a waning moon, but it lit up the land enough for the lead immortals to see movement on their visible horizon. The men of 2nd Brigade, furious at the pounding they'd taken in their wait to advance, were loaded up. Some of them had laser range finders, which showed targets at nearly double their effective range. That word, too, went up the line, and back down came orders to increase speed, the quicker to close the distance and get out of the indirect fire that had to stop soon. Gunners centered on targets that were still too far away, in anticipation of that changing in 2 minutes or less. They felt their mounts speed up, heard the words of their tank commanders to stand by. There were enough targets to count now, and the opposing numbers were not impressive. They had the advantage. They must have, the immortals all thought. But why were the Americans advancing toward them?
"Commence firing at 4,000 meters," the company commander told his crews.
The Abrams tanks were spread nearly 500 meters apart in two staggered lines, covering a lot of ground for one mounted battalion. The TCs mainly kept their heads up and out of the vehicles for the approach phase, then ducked down to activate their own fire control systems.
"I'm on one," one gunner told his TC.
"T-80, identified, range 4250.
"Setting?" the tank commander asked, just to make sure.
"Set on Sabo. Loader, all silver bullets till I say different." I hear you, Gunner. Just don't miss any.
41. The gunner breathed.
He waited for another 15 seconds and became the first in his company to fire and to kill. The 62-ton tank staggered with the shot, then kept moving.
Target, cease fire. Target tank at 11, the TC said over the interphones.
The loader stomped his boot down on the pedal, opened the ammo doors, and yanked out another silver bullet round, then turned in a graceful move, first to guide, then to slam the mainly plastic round into the breech. Up, he called. Identified, the gunner told the TC. Fire. On the way. A pause. The tracer flew true. Right through the dot.
Commander. Target. Cease fire. Traverse right. Target tank at 1.
Loader.
Up.
Gunner. Identified.
Commander.
Fire.
On the way, the gunner said, squeezing off his third shot in 11 seconds.
It wasn't like reality, the battalion commander saw, really too busy watching to take his own shots. It was like an advancing wave. First, the lead rank of T-80s blew up. Just a handful of misses that were corrected 5 seconds later, as the second rank of enemy vehicles started to go. They started to return fire. The flashes looked like the Hoffman simulation charges he'd so recently seen at the NTC, and turned out to be just as harmless. Enemy rounds were marked with their own tracers, and all of their first volley fell short. Some of the T-80s got off a second shot. None got off a third.
"Jesus, sir, give me a target," his gunner called.
"Pick one."
"Bimp," the gunner said, mainly to himself.
He fired off a high-explosive round and got a kill at just over 4,000 meters. But as before, the battle was over in less than a minute. The American line advanced. Some of the BMPs launched missiles, but now they were being engaged by tanks and Bradleys. Vehicles exploded, filling the sky with fire and smoke. Now individual men were visible, mainly running, some turning to fire or trying to deploy. The tank gunners, with nothing large left to shoot, switched to the coaxial machine guns. The Bradleys pulled up level with the tanks, and they did the serious hunting. The lead line of tanks passed through the smoking wreckage of the Immortals division less than 4 minutes after the first volley. Turrets traversed left and right, looking for targets. Tank commanders had their heads back up, hands on their top-mounted heavy machine guns. Where fire originated, it was returned, and at first there was a race to see who could kill the most, because there is an excitement, a rush to battle unknown to those who have never felt it, the feeling of godlike power, the ability to make a life-and-death decision and then enforce it at the touch of a finger. More than that, these guardsmen knew why they were here, knew what they had been sent to avenge. In some, that rage lasted for some minutes, as the vehicles rolled forward, grinding along at less than 10 miles per hour, like farm tractors or harvesting combines, collecting life and converting it to death, looking like something from the dawn of time, utterly inhuman, utterly heartless. But then it began to stop. It stopped being duty. It stopped being revenge. It stopped being the fun they'd expected it to be. It became murder. And one by one, the men on the weapons realized what they themselves were supposed to be and what they might become if they didn't turn away from this. It wasn't like being an aviator, hundreds of meters away, shooting at shapes that moved comically in their aiming systems and were never really human beings at all. These men were closer. They could see the faces and the wounds now, and the harmless backs of people running away. Even those fools who still shot back attracted pity from the gunners who dispatched them. But soon the futility of it was clear to everyone, and soldiers who'd arrived in the desert with rage grew sick at what the rage had become. The guns gradually fell silent, by common consent rather than order, as resistance stopped, and with it the need to kill. Battalion Task Force Lobo rolled completely through the smoking ruin of 2 heavy brigades, searching for targets worthy of professional attention, rather than personal, from which they had to turn away. There was nothing left to be done. The general stood and walked away from his command vehicle, beckoning for the crew to do the same. On his order, they put their weapons down and stood on high ground to wait. They didn't have to wait long. The sun was rising. The first glow of orange was to the east, announcing a new day far different from the old. The first convoy rolled right in front of them, 30 fuel trucks, driving at a good clip, and the drivers must have taken the south moving vehicles for those of their own army. The Bradley gunners of I Troop, 3rd of the 10th, took care of that with a series of shots that ignited the first five trucks. The rest of them halted, two of them turning over and exploding on their own when their drivers rolled them into ditches in their haste to escape. The Bradley crews mainly let the people get clear, plinked the trucks with high explosive rounds, and kept moving south past the bewildered drivers, who just stood there and watched them pass. It was a Bradley that found him. The vehicle pulled to within 50 meters before stopping. The general who, 12 hours before, had commanded a virtually intact armored division, didn't move or resist. He stood quite still, as four infantrymen appeared from the back of the M2A4, advancing with rifles out, while their track covered his detail with even more authority. "On the ground," the corporal called.
"I will tell my men. I speak English. They do not," the general said,
then kept his word. His soldiers went face down. He continued to stand, perhaps hoping that he could die.
"Get those hands up, partner."
This corporal was a police officer in civilian life. The officer, he didn't know what kind yet, but the uniform was too spiffy for a grunt, complied. The corporal next handed his rifle off and drew a pistol, walked in, and held it to the man's head while he searched him expertly.
"Okay, you can get down now. If you play smart, nobody gets hurt. Please tell your men that. We will kill them if we have to, but we ain't going to murder anybody, okay?"
"I will tell them."
With the coming of daylight, Eddington got back into the helicopter he'd borrowed and flew to survey the battlefield. It was soon plain that his brigade had crushed two complete divisions. He ordered his screen forward to scout ahead for the pursuit phase that had to come next, then called Diggs for instructions on what he was supposed to do with prisoners. Before anyone figured that out, a chopper arrived from Riyadh with a television crew. Even before the pictures got out, the rumors did, as they always do in countries lacking a free press. A telephone call arrived in the home of a Russian embassy official. It came just before 7 and awakened him. But he was out of his house in minutes and driving his car through quiet streets to the rendezvous point with a man who, he thought, was finally crossing the line to become an agent of the RVS. The Russian spent 10 extra minutes checking his back, but anyone following him this morning would have to be invisible, and he imagined that a lot of the Ayatollah's security forces had been called up.
"Yes," he said on meeting the man. There wasn't much time for formalities. "You are right. Our army was defeated last night. They called me in at 3 for an opinion of American intentions, and I heard it all. We cannot even talk with our units. The army commander simply vanished. The foreign ministry is in a panic."
As well it might be, the diplomat thought. "I should tell you that the Turkoman leader has...
We know. He called Daryai last night to ask if the plague story was true."
"And what did your leader say?"
"He said that it was an infidel lie. What do you expect?" The official paused. "He was not entirely persuasive. Whatever you said to the man, he is neutralized. India has betrayed us. I learned about that, too. China does not yet know."
"If you expect them to stand with you, you have violated your religion's laws on the consumption of alcohol."
"Of course, my government stands with America as well. You are quite alone," the Russian told him. "I need some information."
"What information?"
"The location of the germ factory. I need that today."
"The experimental farm north of the airport."
"That easy," the Russian thought.
"How can you be sure?"
"The equipment was bought from the Germans and the French. I was in the commercial section then. If you wish to confirm, it should be easy."
"How many farms have guards in uniform?" the man asked helplessly.
The Russian nodded.
"I will see about that. There are other problems. Your country will soon be fully, by which I mean completely, at war with America. My country may be able to offer her good offices to negotiate a settlement of some kind. If you whisper the right word into the right ear, our ambassador is at your disposal, and then you will have done the world a service.
That is simple. By noon we will be looking for a way out of this.
There is no way out for your government.
None, the RVS officer emphasized.
Chapter 63 The Ryan Doctrine The Last Chapter Wars usually begin at exact moments in time, but most often end neither cleanly nor precisely. Daylight found the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment in command of yet another battlefield, having completed the destruction of one of UIR 2nd Corps' divisions. The other division was now facing the Saudi 2nd Brigade, which was attacking from the rising sun, while the American unit halted again to refuel and rearm in preparation for the continued attack on 3rd Corps, still not decisively engaged. But that was already changing. Those two divisions now had the full and undivided attention of all tactical aircraft in theater. First, their air defense assets were targeted. Every radar which switched on drew the attention of HARM, high-speed anti-radiation missile, equipped F-16s, and in 2 hours the skies were friendly to American and Saudi pilots. UIR fighters made an effort to strike down from their home bases to defend their beleaguered ground forces, but none made it past the radar fighter screen set up well beyond the location of the forces they had been dispatched to support. They lost over 60 aircraft in the futile attempt. It was easier for them to lash out at the Kuwaiti brigades, which had so impudently invaded their vastly larger and more powerful neighbor. The small air force of that country was on its own for most of the day, and the battle had little strategic relevance. The routes across the swamps were cut and would take days to repair. The resulting air battle was more a display of mutual anger than anything else, and here too the Kuwaiti forces held the day. Not spectacularly so, but giving 3 kills for every one they absorbed. For a small country learning the martial arts, it was a battle that men would talk of for years, the magnitude of their deeds growing with every recounting. Yet all the deaths on this day would be useless, lives wasted in mere punctuation of a decision already reached. Over 3rd Corps, with the SAMs taken out, attention turned to more structured murder. There were over 600 tanks on the ground, another 800 infantry carriers, more than 200 pieces of towed and self-propelled artillery, several thousand trucks, and 30,000 men, all of them well inside a foreign nation and trying to escape. The F-15E Strike Eagles circled at about 15,000 feet, almost loitering on low power settings, while the weapons systems operators selected targets one by one for laser-guided bombs. The air was clear, the sun was bright, and the battlefield was flat. It was far easier than any exercise in the Nellis bombing range. Lower down in different hunting patches, F-16s joined in with Maverick and conventional bombs. Before noon, 3rd Corps' 3-star commander, correctly thinking himself the senior ground officer, ordered a general retreat, gathered up the support trucks lagered in KKMC, and tried to get his units out in something resembling order. Bombs falling on him from above, the Saudi 5th Brigade approaching from the east, and an American force closing on his rear, he turned northwest, hoping to cross back into friendly territory at the same point he had entered. On the ground, his vehicles used smoke to obscure themselves as best they could, which somewhat frustrated the Allied aviators, who did not, however, come down low to press their attacks, since the UIR forces might have shot back with some effect. That gave the commander hope that he might make it back with something like 2/3 of his strength. Fuel was not a concern. The combined fuel trucks for the entire Army of God were with his corps now. Diggs stopped off first to see Eddington's brigade. He'd seen the sights and smelled the smells before. Tanks could burn for a surprisingly long time, as much as 2 days, from all the fuel and ammunition they carried, and the stink of diesel oil and chemical propellants served to mask the revolting stench of burning human flesh. Armed enemies were always things to be killed, but dead ones soon enough became objects of pity, especially slaughtered as they had been. But only a few, in relative terms, had died by the guns of the men from Carolina. Many more had surrendered. Those had to be gathered, disarmed, counted, and set to work, mainly in disposing of the bodies of their fallen comrades. It was a fact as old as warfare, and the lesson for the defeated was always the same. This is why you don't want to mess with us again. "Now what?" Eddington asked, a cigar in his teeth. The victors suffered through many mood swings on the battlefield, arriving in confusion and haste, facing the unknown with concealed fear, entering battle with determination, and in their case with such wrath as they had never felt, winning with exhilaration, and then feeling horror at the carnage and pity for the vanquished. The cycle changed anew. Most of the mechanized units had reorganized over the last few hours and were ready to move again, while their own MPs and arriving Saudi units took possession of the prisoners gathered by the line units. "Just sit tight," Diggs replied, to Eddington's disappointment and relief. "The remains are running hard. You'd never catch them, and we don't have orders to invade." "They just came at us in the same old way," the guard colonel said, remembering Wellington. "And we stopped them in the same old way. What a terrible business." "Bobby Lee, remember? Chancellorsville?" "Oh, yeah, he was right, too. Those couple of hours, Diggs, getting things set up, maneuvering my battalions, getting the information, acting on it." He shook his head. "I never knew anything could feel like that. But now... it is good that war is so terrible, else we should grow too fond of it. Funny thing is, you forget sometimes." "Those poor bastards," the general said, watching 50 men being herded off to trucks for the ride back to the rear. "Clean up, Colonel. Get your units put back together. There may be orders to move, but I don't think so." "Three Corps?" "Ain't going far, Nick. We're keeping up the skier, and we're running them right into the 10th. "So, you know Bedford Forest after all." It was one of the Confederate officer's most important aphorisms. Keep up the skier. Never give a fleeing enemy the chance to rest. Harry him, punish him, force him into additional errors, run him into the ground, even if it really didn't matter anymore. "My doctoral dissertation was on Hitler as a political manipulator. I didn't much like him either." Diggs smiled and saluted. "You and your people did just fine, Nick. Glad to have you on this trip." "Wouldn't have missed it, sir." The vehicle had diplomatic tags, but the driver and passenger knew that such things had not always been respected in Tehran. Things changed in a country at war, and you could often spot previously clandestine facilities by the fact that they got more guards in time of trouble instead of remaining the same. The latter would have been far smarter, but everyone did it. The car halted. The driver lifted binoculars. The passenger lifted a camera. Sure enough, the experimental farm had armed men around the research building, and that wasn't the normal sort of thing, was it? It was just that easy. The car turned in the road and headed back to the embassy. They were getting only stragglers. The Black Horse was in full pursuit now, and this tail chase was proving to be a long one. American vehicles were better and generally faster than those they were pursuing, but it was easier to run than to chase. Pursuers had to be a little careful about possible ambushes, and the lust to kill more of the enemy was muted by the concern at dying in a war already won. Enemy disorder had allowed the 11th to pull in tight, and the right flank units were now in radio contact with the advancing Saudis, who were just now finishing off the last few battalions of 2nd Corps and thinking about engaging 3rd in a final decisive battle. "Target tank," 1TC said, 10 o'clock, 4100. "Identified," the gunner said as the Abrams halted to make the shot easier. "Hold fire," the TC said suddenly. "They're bailing out. Give 'em a few seconds." "Right." The gunner could see it, too. The T-80's main gun was pointed away, in any case. They waited for the crew to make 100 meters or so. "Okay, take it." "On the way." The breech recoiled, the tank jolted, and the round flew. 3 seconds later, one more tank turret blew straight up. "Jack in the box."
Target, cease fire. Driver, move out, the TC ordered. That made the 12th kill for their tank. The crew wondered what the unit record would be. While the TC made a position notation for the 3-man enemy crew on his IVUS box, which automatically told the regimental security detail where to pick them up. The advancing cavalryman gave them a wide berth. Unlikely though it was, one of them might shoot or do something stupid, and they had neither the time nor the inclination to waste ammunition. One more battle to fight, unless the other side got some brains and just called it a day.
Comments? POTUS asked.
Sure, it sets a precedent, Cliff Rutledge replied.
That's the idea, Ryan said.
They were getting the battlefield video first, unedited. It included the usual horrors, body parts of those ripped to shreds by high explosives, whole bodies of those whose deaths had come from some mysterious cause, a hand reaching out of a personnel carrier whose interior still smoked, some poor bastard who'd almost gotten out, but not quite. There had to be something about carrying a minicam that just drew people to that sort of thing. The dead were dead, and the dead were all victims in one way or another. More than one way, Ryan thought. These soldiers of two previously separate countries and one overlapping culture had died at the hands of armed Americans. But they'd been sent to death by a man whose orders they'd had to follow, who had miscalculated, and who had been willing to use their lives as tokens, gambling chips, quarters in a big slot machine whose arm he'd yanked to see what would result. It wasn't supposed to be that way. Power carried responsibility. Jack knew that he would handwrite a letter to the family of every dead American, just as George Bush had done in 1991. The letters would serve two purposes. They would perhaps be some measure of comfort to the families of the lost. They would certainly remind the man who had ordered them to the field that the dead had once been living. He wondered what their faces had been like. Probably no different from the guardsman who'd formed that honor guard at Indianapolis, the day of his first public appearance. They looked the same, but each human life was individual, the most valuable possession of its owner, and Ryan had played a part in stripping it away. And though he knew it had been necessary, it was also necessary for him, now and for as long as he sat in this building, to remember that they were more than just faces. And that, he told himself, is the difference. I know about my responsibility. He doesn't know about his. He still lived with the illusion that people were responsible to him and not the reverse.
It's political dynamite, Mr. President, Van Damme said.
So?
There is a legal problem, Pat Martin told them. It violates the executive order that President Ford put in place.
I know about that one, Ryan responded. But who decides the executive orders?
The chief executive, sir, Martin answered.
Draft me a new one.
What is that smell?
Back at the Indiana Motel, the truck drivers were out for the morning dance of moving the trucks around to protect the tires. They were sick of this place by now, and heartily wished the travel ban would be lifted soon. One driver had just exercised his Mack and parked it back next to the cement truck. Spring was turning warm, and the metal bodies of the trucks turned the interiors into ovens. In the case of the cement truck, it was having an effect its owners hadn't thought about.
"You got a fuel leak?" he asked Holbrook, then bent down to look.
"No, your tank's okay."
"Maybe somebody had a little spill over at the pumps," the mountain man suggested.
"Don't think so. They just hosed it down a while ago. We better find this. I seen a KW burn once 'cause some mechanic fucked up. Killed the driver. That was on I-40 back in 85. Hell of a mess."
He continued to walk around.
"You got a leak somewhere, old buddy. Let's check your fuel pump," he said next, turning the locks on the hood panels.
Hey, wait a minute, I mean...
"Don't sweat it, pard. I know how to fix the things. I save a good $5,000 a year doing my own work."
The hood went up and the trucker looked inside, reached to shake a few hoses, then felt the fuel line connectors.
"Okay, they're all right."
Next he looked at the line to the injectors. One nut was a little loose, but that was just the lock, and he twisted that back in place. There wasn't anything unusual. He bent down again to look underneath. Nothing dripping. Damn, he concluded, standing back up. Next he checked the wind. Maybe the smell was coming from... No. He could smell breakfast cooking in the restaurant, his next stop of the day. The smell was coming from right here. Something else, too, not just diesel, now that he thought about it. "What's the problem, Coots?" another driver asked, walking over. "Smell that?" And both men stood there, sniffing the air like woodchucks. "Somebody got a bad tank?" "Not that I can see." The first one looked at Holbrook. "Look, I don't want to be unneighborly, but I'm an owner-operator, and I get nervous about my rig, you know. Would you mind moving your truck over there? And I'd have somebody give the engine a look, okay?" "Hey, sure, no problem. Don't mind a bit." Holbrook remounted his truck, started it, and drove it slowly off, turning to park in a fairly vacant part of the lot. The other two watched him do it. "The goddamn smell went away, didn't it, Coots?" "That is a sick truck." "Fuck him. About time for the news. Come on." The other driver waved. "Whoa," they heard on entering the restaurant. The TV was tuned to CNN. The scene looked like something from the special effects department of a major studio. Nothing like that ever was real, but this was. "Colonel, what happened last night?"
"Well, Barry, the enemy came in on us twice. The first time," Eddington explained, holding a cigar in his extended hand, "we sat on that ridge back there. The second time we were advancing, and so were they, and we met right about here."
The camera turned to show two tanks heading up the road past where the colonel was giving his lecture.
"I bet those fuckers are fun to drive," Coote said. "I bet they're fun to shoot."
The scene changed again. The reporter's familiar, handsome face was covered with dust, with the bags of exhaustion under his eyes.
"This is Tom Donner with the press team assigned to the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. How can I describe the night we had? I've been riding with this Bradley crew, and our vehicle and the rest of B Troop have gone through... I don't know how many of the enemy in the past 12 hours. It was War of the Worlds in Saudi Arabia last night, and we were the Martians. The UIR forces, the ones we faced were a mix of Iraqis and Iranians, fought back, or tried to. But nothing they did."
"Shit. Wish they'd have sent my unit," a highway patrolman said, taking his usual seat for his beginning of watch coffee. He'd gotten to know some of the drivers.
"Smokey, you have those in the Ohio Guard?" Coots asked.
"Yep, my unit's armored cavalry. Those boys from Carolina had a big night. Jesus."
The cop shook his head, and in the mirror noticed a man walking in from the parking lot. "Enemy forces are in full flight now. You've just had a report from the National Guard force that defeated 2 complete armored divisions."
"That many? Wow," the cop observed, sipping his coffee.
"The Black Horse has annihilated another. It was like watching a movie. It was like watching a football game between the NFL and the Pop Warner League."
"Welcome to the bigs, you bastards," Coots told the TV screen.
"Hey, is that your cement truck?" the cop asked, turning.
"Yes, sir," Holbrook answered,
stopping on the way to join his friend for breakfast.
"Make sure it don't blow the hell up on you," Coots said, not turning his head.
"What the hell is a cement truck from Montana doing here?" the cop asked lightly.
"Huh?" he added to Coots. "He's got some kind of fuel problem. We asked him to move the rig. Thanks, by the way," he added. "Don't mean to be unneighborly, buddy."
"It's all right. I'll have it checked for sure."
"Why all the way from Montana?" the cop inquired again.
"Well, we bought it there and bringing it east for our business, you know."
"Hmm." Attention returned to the TV.
"Yes, they were coming south, and we drove right into them," a Kuwaiti officer was telling another reporter now.
He patted the gun tube of his tank with the affection he might have shown a prize stallion, a little man who'd grown about a foot in the last day or so, along with his country.
"Any word on when we can get back to work, Smokey?" Coots asked the cop.
The highway patrolman shook his head.
"You know as much as I do. When I leave here, I go up to the line to play roadblock some more."
"Yeah, all that good ticket money you're losing, Smokey Bear," a driver commented with a chuckle.
"I didn't notice the tags. Why the hell drive a cement truck in from Montana?" Coots wondered.
Those guys just didn't fit in.
Maybe he got it cheap, the cop thought, finishing his coffee.
"I don't have anything on the sheet about a hot one.
Damn, I wonder if anyone ever stole one of those."
"Not that I heard of."
"Zap," Coots said.
The current shot was of smart bombs.
"At least it can't hurt much."
"You all have a good one," the cop said on the way out. He entered his Chevy patrol car and headed back to the highway, then decided to give the cement truck a look. Might as well run the tag, he thought. Maybe it was hot. Then he smelled it, too. And to the cop, it wasn't the diesel. Ammonia? It was a smell he'd always associated with ice cream, having once worked a summer in a plant which made it. And also with the smell of propellant in his National Guard cavalry unit. His curiosity aroused, he drove back to the cafe.
"Excuse me, gentlemen, is that your truck parked over on the edge?"
"Yeah, why?" Brown asked. "We do something wrong?" It was his hands that betrayed him. The cop saw them twitch. Something was definitely not right.
"Would you gentlemen come with me, please?"
"Wait a minute. What's the beef here?"
"No beef. I just want to know what that smell is."
"Fair enough."
"We're going to have it looked at."
"You're going to have it looked at right now, gentlemen." He gestured. "If you would, please."
The cop followed them out, got back into his car, and drove behind them as they walked to the truck. They were talking back and forth. Something just wasn't right. His fellow highway cops were not terribly busy at the moment, and on instinct, he called another car for backup and told his headquarters to run the truck tag. That done, he got out and looked up at the truck again.
"You want to turn it over?"
"Okay, sure."
Brown got in and cranked the engine, which was noisy enough.
"What is going on here?" the cop asked Holbrook. "Could I see some identification, please?"
"Hey, I don't understand what the beef is."
"No beef, sir, but I do want to see your ID."
Pete Holbrook pulled out his wallet as another police car arrived. Brown saw it, too, looked down to see Holbrook's wallet and his hand, and the cop's hand on the butt of his pistol. It was just the way cops stood, but Brown didn't think of that. Neither mountain man had a gun handy. They had them in their room, but hadn't thought to carry them to breakfast. The policeman took Pete's driver's license, then walked back to his car, lifting the microphone. "The tag is clean, not in the computer as hot," the lady at the station informed him.
"Thank you."
He tossed the mic back inside and walked back to Peter Holbrook, twirling the license in his hand. Brown saw a cop with his friend, another cop. They'd just talked on the radio. The highway patrolman looked up in surprise as the truck jerked forward. He yelled and pointed for the man to stop. The second car moved to block him, and then the cement truck did stop. That did it. Something was just not right. "Out!" he shouted, his pistol in his hands now. The second officer took control of Holbrook, not having a clue what this was all about. Brown stepped down and felt his collar grabbed and himself thrust against the body of the truck.
"What is the matter with you?" the cop demanded.
It would take hours to find out, and then a very interesting time at the truck stop. There was nothing for him to do but scream, and that, uncharacteristically, he did. The video was undeniable. There was an instant respectability to global TV, and he couldn't stop it from going out. The affluent in his country had their own satellite dishes, and so did many others, including little neighborhood groups. What would he do now? Order them turned off?
"Why aren't they attacking?" Darii demanded.
The Army Commander and all Corps Commanders are off the air. We have some contact with two of our divisions only. One brigade reported it is heading north with enemy forces in pursuit.
And?
And our forces have been defeated, intelligence said.
But how?
Does that matter?
They came on north. Buffalo came on south. UIR Third Corps didn't know what lay ahead. The discovery took place in mid-afternoon. Masterman's first squadron had so far eliminated 100 or so fuel and other trucks, more than the other two battalions. The only question now was how much resistance the enemy would display. From air coverage, he knew exactly where the advancing force was, in what strength and concentration, and in what direction. It was much easier than the last time he'd seen action. A troop was screening in advance, with B and C three clicks back, and the tank company in reserve. As fearful of pounding as their UIR forces were taking, he decided not to use his own artillery yet. No sense warning them that tanks were close by. With contact less than 10 minutes away, he shifted A troop to the right. Unlike the first, and only previous, battle in his career, Duke Masterman wouldn't really see this one. Instead, he listened to it on the radio. A troop engaged at extreme range with both gun tubes and tow missiles, and crumpled the first ragged line of vehicles. The troop commander estimated at least battalion strength as he engaged them from their left front, approaching obliquely in the planned opening maneuver. This UIR division was Iraqi in origin and recoiled the other way, without realizing that it was being herded right into two more cavalry troops.
"This is Gaidan 6. Punch left. Say again, punch left," Masterman ordered from his command track.
B and C turned to the east, sprinted about 3 kilometers, then wheeled back. At about the same time, Masterman let his artillery fire into the enemy's second echelon. There was no surprise to lose now, and it was time to hurt the enemy in every possible way. In another few minutes, it was clear that he was engaging at least a brigade with the first squadron of the Buffalo, but the numbers didn't matter any more now than they had during the night. For one last time, there was a mechanistic horror. The gun flashes were less brilliant in the light of day, and tanks drove through the dust of their own shots as they advanced. As planned, the enemy force recoiled again from the devastating effects of B and C troop, turning back, hoping to find a gap between the first attacking force and the second. What they found were 14 M1A2s of the squadron's tank company, spaced 200 meters apart like a breakwater. As before, first the tanks were destroyed, then the mechanized infantry carriers, as Gaidan rolled into the enemy formation. Then it stopped. Vehicles not yet engaged stopped moving. Crews hopped out and ran away from them. It was the same Masterman heard all the way west on the line. Surprised, running, their exit blocked, the soldiers, lucky enough to see what was rolling toward them in time, decided that resistance was surely fatal, and the third and last battle of KKMC stopped 30 minutes after it had begun. It wasn't quite that easy for the invaders. Advancing Saudi forces, finally in heavy contact, fought a deliberate battle, grinding their way through another brigade, this one Iranian, and therefore getting more attention than an Arab unit might have. But by sunset, all 6 of the UIR divisions that had entered their country were destroyed. Subunits with some lingering fight in them were ordered to surrender by senior officers before enemies on 3 sides could enforce a more final decision. The biggest administrative headache, as before, were the prisoners, all the worse with the additional confusion of nightfall. That problem would last for at least a day, commanders reported. Fortunately, in most cases, the UIR soldiers had water and rations of their own. They were moved away from their equipment and placed under guard. But this far from home, there was little danger of their striking across the desert on foot.
Clark and Chavez left the Russian embassy an hour after nightfall. In the back of their car was a large suitcase whose contents would not appear overly dangerous to anyone, and was, in fact, largely in keeping with their journalistic cover. The mission, they decided, was slightly crazy. But while that troubled the senior member of the team somewhat, it had Ding rather juiced. The premise of it seemed incredible, however, and that had to be verified.
The drive to the alley behind the coffee shop was uneventful. The security perimeter around Darii's home